And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being the land of opportunity. And maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing as anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Yucka, yucka, yucka. This is your host, Dan Plant. Welcome to the Three Left Show. Three lefts, that's three flags, three tendencies of leftism, your anti-capitalist magazine for the week. I hope to change your opinion, a little worldview a little bit with pieces of arguments from different perspectives on various issues that affect us in our day-to-day life, whether we see it or not. So I'm going to head right into it. Sometimes I need to remind myself why I'm in the Green Party. Sometimes, like, say here in New York, have a full Democratic-controlled legislature, and although it's still very doubtful if they're going to pass, you know, kind of the meaningful reforms, to people who have been lobbying and hitting their head against the legislative wall that is a Republican-controlled Senate, something that the governor, Cuomo, set up 6 years ago, basically he would give money to Republican senators to make sure that they stay in their seat. That way, you know, you didn't have to actually pass single-payer health care or rights for immigrants and stuff like that. So he could keep his moderate cred. But now the winds have changed. That was before Bernie Sanders hit the national scene. So now he's got to be as progressive as possible. So now I guess he's okay. It's almost like he kind of let the Democrats take power back. And now they're power hungry. They're passing all kinds of things like gender, rights for trans people and gays and LGB as well. They could be evicted for being gay. You could be fired for being gay and you couldn't sue them back. But this is just a market protection, you know, protection inside the marketplace. And so that's kind of the way reform is. And I have to remind myself, why am I green? You know, if Democrats, let's say the DSA and all these like reform the Dems, work within the Democratic Party, challenge them in primaries, you know, if they're making progress measurable, something noticeable, and then there's a lot of things on the table that weren't, you know, it kind of gives me pause. I'm like, you know, am I doing the right thing with this whole completely independent of the two capitalist parties? Maybe, you know, I'm not going to consider going in that because I did that for 5 years of you know, being on the fence and like going to rallies and lobbying Democrats and writing my congressman and all that stuff. And it just head against the wall, completely repetitious, you know, oh, maybe things have changed, there's all this new energy, Bernie Sanders, blah, blah, blah. But I need to remind myself, what exactly do I want? What am I fighting for? What are my goals? And sometimes when it comes between social Democrats and a far leftist like myself, there is a significant difference in goals. And so maybe, because there's an assumption that, you know, between Green Party and Democrats, that we want the same thing. So you're just messing up the Dems for nothing. Like, no, we actually do want to pull them to the left in serious ways that you may not even be aware of. And I'm going to try to alleviate that. We've had the green, you know, it's in the news cycle now thanks to AOC, you know, her election of a social democrat, or democratic socialist, but social democrat, really. And so it's, the Green New Deal is on the lips of, at least, you know, as far as a name policy, 30 Democrats in the Congress have endorsed it or signed on. And at the moment, it's almost a blank slate of a platform. AOC has her written up plan, but really, like, the first step is to just form a committee to make the plan. And then, much like the banking regulations of Dodd-Frank or the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, it will be written by the congressmen who are completely bought. And you'll have this reform that's called the Green New Deal, but it'll really be a lot of tax giveaways and money to corporations. And there'll be some good tweaks to the system there, but otherwise nothing fundamental. What is fundamental? Let's go into that. So let's go into the Green Party's Green New Deal, which we've had since 2009, you know, which is kind of when the Green Party became something I could take seriously. Because they were all over the place between Nader's run in 2000 and Jill Stein's first run in 2012. And the run up to the 2012 run, where I was like, okay, this isn't a joke party to me anymore, even though I've met and interacted with people regularly who still consider it satire. We only run satire-worthy candidates, which is, to me, personally offensive, if I'm going to put feelings first. But, the facts are that we have serious policy under the hood, and whenever we try to express it, we get the same pushback on any kind of media outlet that, say, AOC is getting. But where she'll say, to put out a very clear difference, you know, when asked, how do you pay for new programs? And she'll say the same way we pay for things now, which is with debt, with, you know, running a deficit, quantitative easing, same way we bail out the banks. But that is, in effect, the same old, and it's not really, to me, powerful. We say we're going to cut the military in half. We'll still be 3 times bigger than China's military, as far as spending is concerned. We're just going to cut the empire in half. You know, we got hundreds of bases. The point is that we can deploy from anywhere in the world at any time. How about we scale that back? So I think it's general opinion that we should be intervening less. And it will really help if we actually don't have the ability to intervene when we want, how we want, where we want. The freedom, the absolute freedom to intervene and kill people and bomb people wherever we like, whenever we please. The Green Party's Green New Deal is split up into 4 sections. First one's economic, obviously. But it starts with an economic bill of rights. You're right. Okay, number one is a kind of guaranteed job program, full employment. Now, there is a really strong, a good debate happening in the far left about whether, like, guaranteed jobs versus guaranteed income. So you hear universal basic income brought up now and then by people like me. And then there's what I usually don't like and bring up, guaranteed jobs. Now, I'm not going to go into the stickiness of one's better than the other or whatever. I prefer the guaranteed income. But as far as the accepted cultural norm in America that one's purpose and income should be earned through a job. Now, I don't agree with that for reasons I can kind of tease out later in the show. But otherwise, I think that's unfair, especially for those who can't hold down a regular job, have disabilities. Just think of people with disabilities. I think that itself is like, oh, we will have exceptions. Well, the amount of people with exceptions are growing every day. And there may be people that are exceptions that you may not consider to be exceptions right now. But the culture norm is everyone has to work. But why? So anyway, let's continue. Oh, yeah, and the means of the guaranteed job is by basically funding a local jobs bank, just giving the money to localities. It's locally controlled what kind of jobs they are and who gets them through a local job bank connected to an employment office. So instead of going to an unemployment office, I mean, I just encountered this with someone I work with where, you know, he goes to the employment office looking for work and there's no work. And thus, again, he is continuously broke and has to panhandle. Number two is the right to organize. At the moment, you know, there's, like with gender, you know, you can't be fired for being gay, but you can be fired if you're organizing for a union. That hasn't been protected ever, I don't think. It's like a political position. It's a political view. And it's kind of been accepted in American conversation that you can fire and you should be able to fire people based on their religious or political views. But at the very least, let's make an exception for unionizing, because this is something that has to do with the actual work, unlike, say, religion or maybe other political beliefs that don't have anything to do with the job and should be kept separate. J- just like church and state should be separate. But labor organizing is very much, you know, connected to doing labor. So let's protect that. Because otherwise, you know, people try to organize, they get fired, they get intimidated, they get threat of firing. Usually something you're only protected from if you have a union. Number three is a single-payer healthcare program, Medicaid for All, which is actually, it's called Medicaid for All in this document, which is odd to me that we take on that language. But hey, whatever. It means the same thing. Just like how universal basic income is like Social Security for everyone. So we could literally call it Social Security for All. And maybe that would sell better as well. Or at least make it, you know, it makes sense to people. All right, you know, full funding for education for all levels and forgiving of student loan debt. This is something Jill Stein talked about whenever she was on TV. And she was, it's called magical thinking to do that. Well, we wiped away the debt for Wall Street. Why can't we do it for guys like me? Guys like people who I know who have way more debt than me. It feels like a third of their income is like as much as rent. Their student loan payment is like second rent. So that means no possible mortgage, no starting of businesses. Number five is right to decent, affordable housing and a halt to foreclosures and evictions. The right to accessible utilities. So public, you know, encouraging and promoting public utilities that are democratically run. That a democratically run is a theme you will hear for this document. And number seven, last point on the economic side, is right to fair taxation. So proportional and ability to pay. And to basically eliminate tax breaks so that any subsidies, corporate or otherwise, are listed in the budget. Right, no more, look, like, I'm paying taxes, I'm just getting a tax break. I'm not on the government dole. No, tax breaks is accepting a subsidy from the government, just like food stamps, just like WIC, just like any other welfare program. Tax breaks count as that as well. And in some cases, when, you know, all homeowners get a property tax rebate, that's like a UBI, especially if it's annually. Every year, you get $1,000. That's a UBI. That's a guaranteed income. Money back from the government that they otherwise would have taken for public good. Number two is a green transition. So when we get into the renewables and stuff. So invest in green businesses, provide grants and low-interest loans to cooperatives and green businesses. This is probably something in the Democratic side as well, if it's listed there. Prioritize green research and then that full jobs program. Which I think is also in that Democrats, you know, when they steal. And by the way, you know, I'm not too annoyed. I am annoyed when, you know, the Dems take like these. They're calling the Green New Deal. They're literally stealing our name. But you know, we didn't copyright it. We don't like copyrights. We don't believe in copyrights. But maybe we should, so we can sue the Social Democrats for taking our name. Earn some money for our campaigns. But that's sneaky. And that's dishonorable, and we're better than that. But we're often punished by the national press for being honorable, any leftist really. Number three is real financial reform. I like to call this domesticating the financial sector. Why? Because like you can, just like Stoic and Buddhist philosophy, the goal is not to, or Stoic philosophy is not to eliminate emotion. But to domesticate your emotions, make them work for you and keep them under control. And with we need to domesticate the financial sector. So this is 8 points going quickly here. Relieve debt. And this is kind of here's the part where, like, you know, this is not going to be on the table as far as the Democratic Congress is concerned. Relieving debt that holds people back on homeowners and students. So that goes back to the other side, but redundancy. Democratize monetary policy by nationalizing the Fed and putting it under the Treasury Department. Many libertarians and far left right wingers want to eliminate the Fed. We just want to nationalize it, make it under Democratic control, so to speak. Break up the banks. Obviously, that's repeated by Sanders people. And bailouts, but in particularly any bank that does fail will go through a resolution process and reopen as a public bank after their underlying assets are sold off. Regulate all federal derivatives, financial derivatives, require them to be traded on open exchanges. Restore Glass-Steagall, that's always on the table with Sanders people, but it will not be on the table with Democrats, not with this Congress, not with Pelosi. And I see the news, you know, Ocasio-Cortez gets put on the Financial Services Committee, so maybe we can break up the banks and whatever with... She's joining, like, other notable Democrats who have been on this committee for a long time. Why haven't these things been pushed? Why hasn't been on the table, you know, to be argued with Republicans, made a national story? Why are there, you know, are they even struggling at all? Or is it all just, you know, because you hear a lot of, we need to work together. We need to get bipartisan bills. Screw that. Support the formation of public banks, right? So number eight is essential to me. Creation of public, municipally owned banks that functions non-profit utilities, meaning taking profit out of the banking sector. All banking and loans should be profit-free, right? That way, we're actually moving past capitalism. Because inflation, the evil of inflation, right? That depresses wages or makes your dollar worth less, is caused by real estate and banking and the profit-making happening in those two sectors. And I'm going to visit the housing sector later. But right now I'm going to talk banking. That inflation is just created by the increase of loans and their profit-making. Keep that in mind. And that, you know, the argument of this show, at its core, is to argue for anti-capitalism and a post-capitalist future. That is, to me, the goal. Everything else is just arguing about the means. Because all kinds of allies and organizing and activism is all over the place. There's no common vision. There's no common goal. And I want something tangible. And at the very least to say, like, well, that we are against capitalism, the market system that creates inflation, that exploits us at every level, whether you're in a McDonald's job or you're in an office with white collar. Your labor, you know, you create value and a good chunk of it goes to the top and it's out of your hands and you have no control over it. It's invested somewhere else or it goes into someone's pocket. In their bank account, and they're hoarding it. The last plank is democracy reforms. Things that, particularly the last two, which is the rein in the security state, you know, the deep state, as it's called, the FBI, the repeal of the Patriot Act, and so on. And then number eight, rein in the military industrial complex, you know, cutting military spending by half. I'll give you a clear example of how this doesn't disrupt the troops or whatever. We can blow up the world three different ways. With nuclear subs, nuclear bombers, and nuclear missiles. How about we just have one way of blowing up the world? One way. We cut the subs and the bombers. We still have the Titan missiles and all the missile silos. We can still blow up the world if we want. We cut out two of those ways. You know, Obama put together the proposal for a $1 trillion spending bill to, quote-unquote, modernize our nuclear capabilities. $1 trillion. Not all spent at once, but over a decade or so. To modernize our nuclear capabilities. Like, we need to blow up the entire world. How about... Gotta go. It's gotta go. Okay, moving on. Welcome back to the Three Left Show. A note on one of those bumpers. I just read, not read, I heard via the Real News Network that the Congolese, Congo, actually just had an election a few months ago after pushing their government to actually have one. So it's kind of a power struggle at the moment between making what results are counted. The Catholic Church in the area, which is the main kind of civil service institution there, monitored the election, and they have a different kind of count than the government published. So it's kind of a fight between getting, because one says that the kind of challenger, the reformer candidate won, and the other says that the kind of chosen candidate of the outgoing tyrant, I'll just say, pick. So I'm just, off script, so lots of ends. So let's I mentioned housing and the causing of inflation and how there's a lot of these reformist policies that sound great on paper when they're said. You know, affordable housing. Who wants to want that? But whether it's a local activist, housing nonprofits, or the Democratic Party, or other levels, affordable housing just isn't really attainable under this economic system. As long as we have for-profit banking and real estate industry, right, that you profit from selling and buying homes, that's creating the environment that doesn't keep costs down. Okay, whether it's labor or just any part of it. The fact that a profit must be made as far as banks are concerned, and then you have all the incentives to maximize that profit. So here is a perspective from CityLab, published by CityLab, written by Daniel Hertz, fellow Dan, a senior fellow at the City Observatory. Title is, Housing Can't Be Both Affordable and a Good Investment. The two pillars of American housing policy are fundamentally at odds, published November last year. Promoting home ownership as an investment strategy is a risky proposition. No financial advisor recommends going into debt in order to put such a massive part of your savings in any other single financial instrument. And one that, as we just learned a few years ago, referring to those six, carries a great deal of risk. Even worse, that risk isn't random. It falls most heavily on low-income Black Hispanic buyers who are given the worst mortgage terms and whose neighborhoods are systematically more likely to see low and even falling home values, with devastating effects on the racial wealth gap, as it has been. But let's put all that aside for a moment. What if housing were a low-risk, can't-miss bet for growing your personal wealth? I think for white people, I think it can be. What would the world look like? Well, in order for your home to offer you a real profit, its price would need to increase faster than the rate of inflation. Let's pick something decent, not too extreme. Say, annual increase of 2.5%, taking inflation into account. So if you bought a home at 20 grand, 200 grand, and sold it 10 years later, you'd be looking at a healthy profit of $56,000. Sound good? Well, what if I told you that such a city existed? What if I told you that in a beautiful natural setting with hills and views and a booming economy and lots of organic produce? Pictures, San Francisco. Maybe you've guessed by now that this wonderland is San Fran. When researcher Eric Fisher went back to construct a database of rental prices there, he found that the rents had been growing by 2.5% net of inflation for 60 years. As the Zillow data suggests, San Fran owner-occupied home prices have been growing at the same rate since 1980. Like I said, over 10 years, that gives you a profit of over 25%. But compound interest is an amazing thing, and the longer this consistent wealth building goes on, the more out-of-hand housing prices get. In 1980, Zillow's home price index for San Fran homes were $310,000. By 2015, with that growth, it had grown to $750,000. For comparison, in my area, the standard home price is $125,000. And that's still way out of reach for a lot of working people. Now, if all you cared about was wealth building, this would be fantastic news. The system works! Although, actually, even this rosy scenario is missing some wrinkles. San Fran real estate prices did suffer enormously, though briefly, in the 06 crash. And had to sell in, say, 2010, you have taken a loss. But this sort of wealth building is predicated on a never-ending stream of new people who are willing and able to pay current homeowners increasingly absurd amounts of money for their homes. Now, I'm going to stop for a moment and point out that in a week or so, in the future, I'm going to have back on Leela, a guest I had on last year, and we're going to talk about multi-level marketing, also known as pyramid schemes that involve retail products. And when I think about retail pyramid schemes of that nature, I tend to kind of extrapolate it to the whole economy. Like, isn't everything just a pyramid scheme when you think about it? It's just not as exploitative. But, of course, it all is exploitative. You know, one layer at the top or in the middle relies on a larger base below being screwed over and over and over again. You know, that real estate, you know, for one person to make a profit on buying and flipping a house, there needs to be a massive amount of people under them who are willing to buy said houses at inflated prices, or workers who are renting and then have to take a second and then a third job. They have to just work more and more and more, earning with less earning power. Now, of course, as prices rise, the only young people able to buy this Ponzi scheme are quite well-to-do themselves. And because we're not talking about stocks but homes, buying into a Ponzi scheme means able to live in San Francisco. In other words, possibly the only thing worse ownership doesn't work as a wealth-building tool is a world in which it does work as a wealth-building tool. Similar logic to, you know, when I say the only thing worse than being unemployed is being employed, and vice versa. This also means that the two stated pillars of American housing policy, homeownership as wealth building, and housing affordability, something that I see in liberal circles around me all the time, that like, oh, we need to encourage homeownership. Homeownership is how people build wealth. Because they certainly can't do it through wages. They certainly can't do it through wages. That they're fundamentally at odds. American housing policy resolves this contradiction by quietly deciding that it really doesn't care much about affordability after all. While funds for low-income subsidized housing languish, most larger pots of money are set aside for promoting homeownership through subsidies like mortgage interest deduction, capital gains exemptions, most of which go to upper and upper middle class households, creating thus more inequality. But even markets with large amounts of affordable housing demonstrate the contradiction, a contradiction of capitalism. Since at least the second half of the 20th century, the vast majority of actual affordable housing has been created via filtering. That is, the falling relative price of a market rate home as it ages, or its neighborhood loses social status, often a result of a racial change. Low income affordability, where it does exist, is predicated on large portions of the housing market acting as a terrible investment. Meaning, homes are only affordable if it's a ghetto, in which no bank will want to actually sell you a mortgage. Many banks are not selling mortgages at all. I kind of got fed up and left a housing advocacy group when the thing we were debating about was, like, the policy we were going to be fighting for was we need to get the local big bank to start getting mortgages again because they had stopped since the housing crash. I'm like, we're not trying to start more land trusts or a public bank that could actually loan people money at a fair rate. Well, we want a profit-driven enterprise to be in charge of giving mortgages out again to promote homeownership, you know. So to the extent that low-income people do find a subsidized price-fixed housing unit to live in, that means that they won't be building any wealth, even as their richer market housing-dwelling neighbors do, increasing wealth inequality. Yeah, I just pointed that out. Even with community land trusts, which seems to be a way of squaring the wealth-building affordability circle, this also fails. Community land trusts typically provide subsidized or reduced price ownership opportunities to initial buyers and assure longer-term affordability by limiting the resale price of the home. In other words, community land trust financed home remains affordable only because they restrict how much wealth building the initial owner is able to capture. This result is that community land trust finance homes only attract those who couldn't otherwise purchase a home, which means that the lower income people in a community land trust will be building wealth more slowly, which as far as moving towards a post-capitalist economy is just fine, taking the profit making out of owning a home, right? But it doesn't build wealth for those people. And the community land trust in Albany has kind of hit a plateau. They're slowly maybe buying two houses a year or fixing them up, and it's just hard for them to get financing, just like anyone else. And it's sad, because I asked the guy who's been in the game for decades and decades. You know, the Lehman Land Trust was started in the 80s by a bunch of hippies, and they argued a lot, and they didn't have good organization, but they got through it, and they built something. But they also kind of are just another landlord sometimes, and even though it's affordable, but it's still like when they're selling a house, it's still $90,000, $100,000. And if you're on minimum wage or working part time. That's still out of reach, and you still need a mortgage to pay for that. And there's no one to give mortgages. There's the state agency, but you need to be of a certain income level, and I'm not. I don't fit that either. I mean, the income level, I mean, I think it went, and because I asked, like, what could the minimum payment be? And let's say the house is so-and-so price, like $800, $900. And that's not affordable to me. I mean, even if I had a full-time job, I don't think that would be the case. Unless it was an actual salary job where, you know, I do have $50,000 annually, which is hard to achieve. We say that we want housing to be cheap and we want home ownership to be a great financial investment. Until we realize that these two objectives are mutually exclusive, we'll continue to be frustrated by failed and oftentimes counterproductive housing policies. So it's this kind of realization that kind of drives me to not only the Green Party, but just radical politics in general that seeks fundamental changes. Fundamental changes in banking, fundamental changes in how housing is created and provided. Like, if all housing was public housing, it would kind of, a lot of these problems would go away. To just make a really general point about it. Obviously, there's a lot of other things to say. What else can I say about housing? Housing. You know, the Green Party, we're all about scattershot development, meaning instead of big towers, actually building townhouses, just lots and lots of them, to actually fill in the gaps. Because in our Beltway and Rust Belt cities, lots of vacant land to build on. And lots of demand for affordable housing. The market just isn't providing it. The market doesn't. So government has to fill in the gaps. But since government, even when dominated by Democrats, still want to use market mechanisms. They want to just subsidize developers, for-profit developers, who just cry about how it's just they won't make their profit unless they don't have unless they don't pay any taxes. And so here in Albany, we have policy. Our housing policy consists of giving people basically no property taxes for 10 years, no property taxes for 15 years, no property taxes for 5 years. This creates massive holes in the budget because these developments have public costs, more traffic, more energy and infrastructure use, things that the city has to pay for, but they're not putting in the money. Because they couldn't make a profit otherwise to develop because of real estate pricing, because of how the financial sector funds them and other investors. You know, but of course, you know, main investment comes from big firms. So I'll leave you with that because it's just how messed up that it all is. I wish development was all nonprofit. I wish our whole economy was nonprofit. This is what I'm advocating, and I just want everyone to be on some kind of same level page. Welcome back to the Three Left Show, your far leftist news magazine for a post-capitalist future. So I talked about how there's a contradiction in housing policy, that housing can never be affordable as long as they're it's not a marketplace with for-profit institutions and drivers and all that stuff. Unless it's all publicly financed and publicly built for the common good, then we're not going to have housing as a right. And we're going to have homelessness, and we're going to have people paying a majority of their income into housing. Something that is so easily built, but, you know, it's land and development, speculation on land. And that's where it's not just real estate, of course, but bank, the financial sector as well, that speculates on land and buys up massive quantities of urban land to develop. And then they sell it for high cost to the developers, and then they have to pass on that cost to you, us, the little guy. And we can organize tenant unions, and we can organize land trusts and public and try to buy up land with nonprofits and stuff and say this is for the common good. We're not in this to build our own individual wealth, but we want to build community wealth. Until that's happening in a big way, and it is certainly happening in certain areas of Detroit and sacrifice areas that have been completely abandoned and where there's really nothing else to do, where the land is just sold for a few dollars. We have a county land bank, which will also sell vacant lots for, you know, $50. But you need to, like, prove that you're going to make it productive on the marketplace or do it for some community benefit that you will be developing it, which, you know, is once you have infrastructure in place. But sometimes you need the land first to bring people together to do something with it. So sometimes there are some catch-22s, and you have to play this kind of political runaround game. So I'm going to go to a Verso article on the same theme of contradictions within capitalist industry and our economy. Just what is our economy? And it's called the Green Delusion. Industrial-scale renewable energy is fossil fuel plus. Industrial-scale renewable energy does nothing to remake exploitative relationships with the Earth. Instead, represent renewal and expansion of the present order. So this article is to strike hard at kind of some fundamental problems I have and not enough other people have about all this talk of renewable energy. You know, sometimes, you know, I'm met, you know, because I'm surrounded by people. Not surrounded, but, you know, I meet and I'm friendly. I have allies with people who just want more renewable energy. Like, the goal is 100% renewables. But there's a misunderstanding that this article gets to towards the end, that so much of the energy we use is wasted. You know, 40% of all energy produced is wasted just in transmission. It leaks out of the power lines. Not to mention what is even being used for. Lighting up car dealership parking lots, office buildings that are empty, changing your light bulbs as an individual in your residential residence is nothing compared to the power usage and the electricity usage of large companies and firms and industry as a whole. And this gets to that it's not enough. Like, we just have to actually reduce energy use. If we reduce energy use, it wouldn't just be a matter of changing over to renewables, but we could actually just use less fossil fuels. And as the case, since energy use is still kind of increasing, even with efficiency gains, just overall because of population growth and what have you, that we may find out that, and I have another study that I'll go into in the next hour, that it may not actually have, like, changing over to a renewable economy may not have made any difference on the economy whatsoever. Especially since, say, if we're all still eating meat and having a diet that, where basically half of the U.S. land has to be used for growing corn. So let's dig into this, all right? Because this is going pretty deep as far as, like, it just isn't good enough to say, you know, oh, more solar power, you know, solar panels on my roof. I'm responsible participant of capitalism now. There is no ethical consumption. Something has to be exploited in capitalism. That is a fundamental truth that I think this episode is about getting to the heart of. So in this case, even if we have a fully renewable energy economy, the Earth is still being exploited. Let's get into it. Renewable energy is not the solution we think it is. And this is written by an Alexander Dunlap, May of last year. We have inherited the bad good energy dichotomy of fossil fuels versus renewable energy, a holdover from the environmental movement of the 70s. That is misleading, if not false. Fossil fuels are correctly understood to be at the heart of capitalism, industry, and state formation, the results of which have been ecologically catastrophic. Meanwhile, industrial-scale renewable energy has emerged as a protagonist in our time, positioned as a solution to our ever-increasing energy consumption. Along with market-based conservation and natural capital policymaking, it is taken to be among the central mitigating force against climate change. With the rise of the green economy and capital change legislation, renewable energy includes the harnessing of wind, solar, and apparently infinite natural resources to meet energy consumption on an unprecedented ever-expanding scale. However, contrary to the claims of its proponents, it by no means adequately addresses the real problem posed by current levels of energy consumption, which are driven by capitalist growth imperative, that only cause ecological degradation and climate change we see. A focus on the technocratic issue of energy consumption often leaves unchallenged the political economic violence that is intrinsic to our social system. If these words are comboed and too big, it's generally saying that it doesn't matter how much energy, how the size of your energy bill, because there are people in other countries whose lives have to be destroyed, environments that have to be destroyed, hellscapes that need to be produced to create our lifestyle, the American way. And the goal seems to be that we can keep the American way of suburbia and happy motoring if we just make everything electric. Not true. Industrial-scale renewable energy does nothing to remake the exploitative relationship with the Earth, the extreme bottom of the pyramid, if we would consider our economy to be a pyramid scheme. You know, the 1% exploits the top 10%, the top 10% exploits the bottom 50, and then the bottom 50 then has to exploit the Earth and all other life. The excessive concern with possible energy solution within capitalism, as opposed to a more fundamental social transformation, expresses our inability to imagine any other way of living, blinding us to the deeper social ecological insurrection that climate change has made necessary, meaning revolution or death. Industrial scale renewable energy and the grid-centric system it powers represents the renewal and expansion of a present capitalist order, the status quo. Not only are, and by the way, that Trump is a clear, wonderful example of. Not only are existing social discontents like inequality, discrimination, and exploitation reinforced by renewable energy, but the amount of infrastructure it presently requires clearly indicates the ecological costs involved with its full implementation. Putting up wind farms isn't free. The wind and solar parks that span across fields and hillsides as far as one can see are harbingers of what this new energy system would look like. Where does all this metal come from? How much energy can it produce? And what kind of society do these systems enable? Here, this gets to the heart of it. This is a great story here. So in 1980, American Indian Movement activist Russell Means explained the uncomfortable reality of extraction or extractivism, just the process, the need to extract, in native territory. Confronting a room of revolutionary communists about their desire for industrialism, Mean said, "Right now, today, we who live on the Pine Ridge Reservation are living in what Euro society has designated a national sacrifice area. What this means is that we have a lot of uranium deposits here, and Euro culture, not us, needs this uranium as energy production material. The cheapest, most efficient way for industry to extract and deal with the processing of this uranium is to dump the waste byproduct right here at the digging sites. Right here where we live. This waste is radioactive, of course, and will make the entire region uninhabitable forever. This is considered by industry and the white society which created it to be an acceptable price to pay for energy resource development, particularly nuclear energy. Along the way, they also plan to drain the water table under this area of South Dakota as part of the industrial process, so the region becomes doubly uninhabitable. The same sort of thing is happening down in the land of the Navajo and the Hopi, up in the land of the Northern Cheyenne and Crow and elsewhere. Over 60% of all U.S. energy resources have been found to lie under reservation land. So there's no way this can be called a minor issue. For American Indians, it's a question of survival in the purest sense of the term. For white society and its industry, it's a question of being able to continue to exist in its present form. We are resisting being turned into a national sacrifice area for resisting being turned into a national sacrifice people. The costs of this industrial process are not acceptable. It is genocide to dig for the uranium here and to drain the water table. No more, no less. So the reasons for our resistance are obvious enough and shouldn't have to be explained further to anyone. Like the mining of fossil fuels, back to the writer, the sitting and inciting and implementation of renewable energy system entails the creation of such sacrifice zones, often on indigenous land, but even if it wasn't, sacrifice zones, bad. These projects have thus confronted considerable pushback from rural and indigenous populations, and the struggles around extraction outlined by Means have only continued to intensify. By clinging to the ideas of sustainable development and the green economy, progressives and other conscientious citizens, no doubt with good motives and intentions, are staking the future of the planet on dubious mechanisms of oversight rife with conflicts of interest. The proliferation of voluntary UN standards, corporate social responsibility initiatives, private auditing firms, and free prior informed consent are but band-aids of good intentions, also called by me and others, greenwashing. The distinctions drawn between fossil fuels and renewable energy involve a sleight of hand that masks the continued ecological degradations necessary for the continuation of consumer society. For example, renewable energy requires immense amounts of mineral and fossil fuel resources, both in the construction of the machinery necessary, the transportation of it to site, and so on and so on. For all these reasons, instead of conceiving renewable energy as a green environmental solution, industrial and utility-scale renewable energy is more accurately referred to as fossil fuel plus. Let's focus the discussion on a single form, wind energy, poster child for renewables. It is increasingly becoming a preeminent approach to climate change mitigation. Through my fieldwork in the Itmus of Temopachic region in Mexico, where I was embedded for 6 months in a policia comunitaria, I have been able to witness firsthand the struggles and negative outcomes involved in the implementation of this form of renewable energy. Consider, for example, the resources required to construct a single 2-megawatt wind turbine. One of these turbines uses roughly 150 metric tons of steel, 250 tons of rotor hubs and nacelles, 500 metric tons for the tower, and close to 4 tons of copper per megawatt. For a more industrial steel production is impossible without burning coal. As metallurgical coal, or coking coal as it's called, is a vital ingredient. Now imagine reasons like the Itmus of Tecopachic, where roughly 1,700 wind turbines operate to provide energy to Walmart, Grupo Bimbo, industrial construction, mining, and other companies and industries. These turbines require significant amounts of mining at every stage of the mining process, from extraction, processing, transport, construction. To some degree, operation require large expenditures use of fossil fuels, a fact that is often neglected in the ecological accounting. And is something that is part of conversations in architecture. When we're talking about green building, what does it mean for a building to be net zero? LEED standards didn't include transportation and the actual making of materials. And in this way, this is kind of what turned me on to this problem. That unless you're building with natural materials that are nearby, how can it be carbon neutral? You know, or how can it, in fact, give more to the land that it is taking away? To take and take and take is truly unsustainable. It's resources on the planet are infinite. But I think I've made my point here about this. And the hellscape around this industrial area, this Itmus, is a hellscape because it has the wind power is being used to power all this other polluting industry that is completely unregulated and hellscape, creates hellscape. Oh, yeah, and the rare earth metal. So unless it's a mechanical turbine to make the magnets and so on, you need rare earth metals, which only come from two places in the world, China and most of them do come from China. Oh, yeah, or Central Asia. So get those minerals out. A lot of mining. Oh, yeah, and here's a strike against electric cars, okay? In order for electric cars to actually replace the number of cars we have or even half the amount of cars that are bought every year would take more than the actual annual production of rare earth minerals that China does, right? They can't really produce more because eventually it's going to run out. How long can this actually keep going? There's only so many lithium car batteries you can make. There's only so many, you know, and that's why the hydrogen batteries are like, needs to be researched and stepped up, because making batteries out of rare earth minerals is just, it's impossible to actually replace our economy with it, right? Half of the population or more would need to just give up driving, as I believe they should. But I'm stating that if you want to be conscious of your resource use and think switching to electric or self-driving car is going to solve a problem, it doesn't. It doesn't. I know it's a hard truth, hard pill to swallow. And maybe this could be the first time you're hearing something like this, this argument. Hopefully it won't be the last. You know, this is sustainable violence. It's not just a result of bad governance. It's strictly bound up in industrial extraction. You know, the costs, the harm to people. You know, the people that people in charities will donate $5 to. Why do you think they're poor? Why do you think, like, their lives suck? It's because of big industry. It's because of the things that our economy depends on. It doesn't matter how many, you know, children you adopt via charities or whatever. It doesn't change the fact that their environment's going to be dead for the next generation or more. So when liberals and progressives, quote-unquote the left, and even environmental justice advocates applaud the large-scale transition to renewable energy, they ignore the many hazards that would otherwise be unacceptable to them. Displacing fossil fuel industries to the global south, where there are fewer environmental regulations and political rights, makes possible the use of excessive forms of state-private security violence against anyone who might protest them. Furthermore, the material necessary for renewable energy can only result in an increase in extraction of the South, of a global South, and all the negative consequences this entails. If we do not confront these facts, then the solution of today, like previous energy systems and regime changes, will likely result in the complicated tyrannies of tomorrow. Recognizing renewable energy as fossil fuel plus is the first step to combat the fairy tale of renewable energy. By highlighting the myths surrounding renewable energy, we can also create the groundwork for a greater environmental consideration and enactment of a radical alternatives that address the roots of our consumer society.
First, my profound thanks for listening to the show. Without which, there would be no reason for me to make it. If you want to support the show materially, check us out on Patreon, Three Left Show page. You could always use the help to take this show to the next level. You can also share the show socially. Support us that way on social media pages, on Twitter and Facebook, and particularly in person, the most effective way of convincing people to check something out. You can always listen to the show on our website, threelefts.news, where all episodes are archived and there's also other info. If you'd like to be on the show personally, contact me via the social media pages I mentioned. This has been Dan Platt of Three Left Show. I just ask you to be well, be rad, wave our flags, and let's keep moving in that different direction.